From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, votes all over a Russian plane mystery, Ben Carson takes heat, and unemployment officially down to 5%. In Egypt, a Russian plane comes down, all 224 aboard dead, and lots of talk of terrorism, President Obama.
I think there is a possibility that there was a bomb on board.
GOP candidates demanded more debate control this week. Fox News' Megyn Kelly and Chris Tarwalt weren't having it.
Can you imagine having to submit our graphics for approval to the candidates? Good
I
luck with that.
And we won't.
And former President George H.W. Bush criticized his sons, President George W. Bush's administration, singling out Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Here's NBC's Andrea Mitchell.
For the first time, the father is breaking his silence about some of the son's most trusted war advisors, slamming Dick Cheney as an iron ass, Donald Rumsfeld as an arrogant fellow.
Okay, this hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Sam Youngman from the Lexington Herald Leader in Kentucky, Juana Summers from Mashable, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in that Russian plane? Pot in Ohio, Ben Carson's view of history, Kentucky's politics. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Lexington, Kentucky is Sam Youngman, political reporter for the Lexington Herald Leader, former political reporter for Reuters in Washington. Sam, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
With us from Baltimore, Juana Summers is here, political editor at Mashable, former congressional reporter for NPR. Juana, it's Old Home Week. Great to have you back as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Sam, and Juana.
Let's go first to that Russian plane. Lots of speculation about it at this point, but people in very high places, like the Oval Office, saying could have been a bomb. Here was a CNN aviation analyst on Wednesday kind of telling us what we could kind of see.
The confirmation that this airplane was falling at such a rapid speed vertically and horizontally indicates that this airplane was a brick. At some point in time, something caused it to be a brick.
A brick just out of commission. But what? That is what everyone's trying to figure out. All kinds of chaos and uproar in Sharm el-Sheikh there, resort in Egypt. Here was Mike Rogers, former congressman, former House Intelligence Committee chairman, talking about the Russian airplane crash, again with CNN.
Clearly, the Russians don't want to give in to the fact yet that there may have been a bomb planted on an airplane, and that they're going to hold on to that as long as they possibly can until they get a level of certainty. And same with Egypt. They don't want people to stop flying into places like Sharm el-Sheikh.
Okay, it's a long way from Lexington, Kentucky, but Sam Youngman, you can see everybody squirming with this. A huge death toll there, and of course it comes after the Russian military has intervened in a big way in Syria. ISIS has claimed credit for this. The British, very quick to say this could be terror, this may well be a bomb. President Obama saying something quite similar here. What are the stakes? What does it say about ISIS and its reach, Sam, if this does prove to be a bomb?
Well, I think one of the reasons you're seeing the reluctance on the part of some parties to say this was terrorism or to say it was a bomb is because it opens us up to some very uncomfortable truths. But I think any time the President of the United States won't just out of hand discount terrorism as a possibility, that sends a message. I mean, I think this is something that we definitely need to be taking seriously.
Juana Summers, I don't know how this looks politically, but you've got a lot of Americans who don't want to get involved in Syria saying not our problem. If ISIS starts reaching out with attacks abroad, of an international air carrier here, does that raise the heat for Washington to remain focused on ISIS?
I think it almost certainly does. And what you've heard from a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill so far this week is this urge that we don't really know what happened quite yet, that no possibility is ruled out, but that we need to be skeptical. We need to take a look at this. I think one encouraging sign you're seeing is that Russian President Vladimir Putin on Friday suspended all flights from Russia to Egypt. And that's kind of the first response we've seen after significant silence from both Egypt and from Russia on this issue. I would expect lawmakers and here in Washington to start really focusing on that in the days ahead and as as kind of a, something that we should be watching in terms of how we communicate with our foreign partners.
Sam Youngman, Vladimir Putin puts his machismo right out front. If it is shown that this was a bomb and can be linked somehow to ISIS, I mean, so far we're told Russia has been more restrained on going after ISIS in Syria. It's given more of its attention, its bombing, to opponents of Syria's leader Assad. Could you see them turning more fiercely on ISIS if their plane has been taken down?
Well, I think anytime you're trying to predict future behavior on the part of Vladimir Putin, you're playing a dangerous guessing game. I think if the, you know, if the traditional rules of engagement were applied, then yes, that would be the case. But I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing such reluctance on his part to sort of talk about what this really was.
Jack, thoughts on the Russian airliner?
Well, you know, it's an ominous development for the United States. Russia is engaged peripherally against ISIS. We are engaged directly against ISIS. And Dan Bynum, the strategic analyst at Georgetown, frequent guest on this show, warns in Slate that the battlefield may well be expanding. That is, ISIS may now be, you know, trying to, through its affiliates, grow the range of conflict so that it isn't just Americans who, you know, blunder into are captured by ISIS, but Americans perhaps anywhere might be targets, and that if Russia is being targeted now, America could be targeted in indirect ways later.
We've got a lot to look at politically and at home this week. Elections all over the country. Very interesting political developments in Kentucky. Sam will look at those. Across the border in Ohio, there was a push for legalization of marijuana. It was defeated. Here's Curtis Steiner, campaign director for Ohioans Against Marijuana Monopolies, celebrating that defeat, which would have legalized marijuana in the Buckeye State.
Issue 3 was designed and built primarily to garner massive and exclusive profits for a small group of self-selected wealthy investors. Issue 3 was about greed, not good public policy.
Sam Youngman, look across the border from Kentucky. What do you see in the Ohio vote on pot? Pot's been gaining more acceptance, but here, key state, big state, and turned right back.
Yeah, I think that word monopoly was really a poison pill from the beginning that supporters of the legislation were just never able to get away from. And the other thing I would say is this, you know, generally when you're talking about change in public policy, you're talking about incremental change. You look at other states that have gone from complete prohibition to legalizing medicinal marijuana and then on to recreational marijuana. This sort of skipped those middle steps and went straight from prohibition to legalized recreational use. And I think that's it would have been unusual for Ohio voters to make that leap.
Was it a fair characterization? Did the sponsors of this referendum stand to profit from this? Were they, in fact, trying to build a marijuana cultivation monopoly for themselves?
Well, I don't think actually it's technically a monopoly. I think it would be an ogolopy. So I don't know that the characterization was fair, but I do think it dramatically, especially the way it was framed, dramatically hurt the bill's chances.
Juana Summers, how do you see this pot setback in Ohio? All about monopoly and people wondering who was going to make the money? Or is there more resistance to acceptance of pot in this country than other examples, Colorado, might lead you to believe?
First of all, I think Sam's point is absolutely well taken. This is a proposal that was so noxious to marijuana advocates that even big groups like, say, the Drug Policy Alliance and the Marijuana Policy Project refrained from endorsing this Ohio bill. It was constructed in such a way that not even the biggest names in the pot lobby and pot politics actually wanted to get behind it. I would hesitate taking this as a beacon for what the fight over marijuana, either at the federal level for legalization or at the state-by-state level, could mean, just because this was such a unique situation. Of course, this bill would have legalized both recreational and medicinal marijuana at the same time. It was constructed in a very narrow way that many people who opposed it say would not allow folks to grow at home. So I think that this is really an outlier. And also, let's keep in mind, this is an off-year election where you're going to see a lot less interest in these types of issues. So I really think that this is an outlier, and that there are probably, I think, a handful, maybe 10, maybe a dozen other states that are pushing towards their own bills that would touch on legalization right now. And I think that those are probably a better barometer of how the nation feels about this issue than the offshoot battle that we saw in Ohio earlier this week.
Let's take it to Houston, a vote there with another cultural face, but a vote on LGBT rights. And it went down very strong, 60-something to 30-something percent defeat there. Here was Jared Woodfill, lead opponent of the Houston non-discrimination ordinance, celebrating the outcome of Tuesday's vote.
Everyday Houstonians, we're going to have to live under this ordinance, stood up and overwhelmingly said no to men and women's bathrooms, showers, and locker rooms.
Jack, you know, there was a lot under this umbrella. And, of course, yeah, the lesbian mayor in Houston who had pushed hard for this, it went down to a big defeat. It got reduced in many quarters to this debate over who was going to be in the bathroom, whether it would be a transgender man, woman, you know, what hardware would be coming in there, anatomically speaking. What do you think of this, Jack? Is this another pushback front or something very culturally, broadly, or something very specific?
Well, it's hard to know how far to generalize from it. I do note that the Houston City Council, which voted the ordinance, according to the Times reporting, initially had something in there referring to bathroom use and then struck it out. Well, once they had let that phrase out, it caught on among the opponents. The New York Times calls it a victory for bigotry. I don't know about that. But it's certainly a victory for effective advertising in politics and for scaring people on what might have been, and I'm not clear on this, a very peripheral issue entirely.
Sam, we're going to come to Kentucky and the hard move to the red category, the Republican category there. But I wonder, between what you've seen in Kentucky and what we saw in Houston and maybe some penumbra in Ohio, if you feel a conservative cultural pushback this week, Sam.
Well, I'm generally hesitant to make such sweeping declarations or declare a trend, especially as Juana mentioned, in off-year elections. Mm-hmm. For example, in Kentucky, we only had about a 30% turnout. But I do think that there's certainly a backlash following a summer of tremendous social change. You know, Kentucky has been really one of the premier battlegrounds in that. So, yes, I think you're certainly seeing some backlash.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. A Russian plane down, pot loses, Airbnb wins, gay rights lose in Houston, a Bush family rumble. We'll look at that. Ben Carson on the pyramids and more. Juana Summers is with us from Baltimore, politics editor for Mashable. Sam Youngman is here from the Lexington Herald Leader, political reporter there. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What are you thinking on Ben Carson's stories and the pyramid, Trump and his new book, Crippled America, Rubio and the credit card stuff, the rumble over debate rules? Are you surprised that Father Bush, Bush H.W., has taken a swing at Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, sort of at his own son? And how do you read the TransCanada rolling back its Keystone Pipeline push this week? Sam Youngman, tell us what happened in Kentucky when it comes to politics this week.
Well, the only way I know how, a lot of us who do this for a living got our pants pulled down. Matt Bevin, the Republican candidate, you may remember the name. Last year, he ran an unsuccessful campaign against Mitch McConnell in the Republican primary here, jumped to a 9-point landslide win over Democrat Jack Conway, even though Conway had led in virtually every poll that we saw by about 5 points. So I think you have to, going back to what we were talking about before the break, I think you have to consider that sort of a backlash to a summer of social change was part and parcel of what happened here, especially when you consider that Kim Davis, the Rowan County clerk here, who was jailed for defying a federal judge's orders to issue gay marriage license, she was making robocalls on Bevin's behalf. He of course, rushed to her defense. He was there when former Governor Mike Huckabee and Senator Ted Cruz were there. So I do think that there's very much this coalition of evangelical and Tea Party voters out there who despite reports that they've that their influence has diminished, are still a force to be reckoned with.
Here Tuesday night, Kentucky's new governor-elect, Republican Matt Bevin, celebrating his win.
I'm proud for the fact that this is a great night for the Republican Party in the state of Kentucky. I'm also grateful for the fact that, even more importantly, this is a great night for conservatives in the state of Kentucky.
A massacre from top to bottom for Democrats, Sam Youngman writes, in a state that had long been very heavily Democratic. Now he says, politically, this state is red, not purple, not pink, not reddish, but red, really red. Might well have been the end of the Democratic Party in a state where it dominated for so long, Republicans blew the doors off Democrats. And this is Matt Bevin, what supported Kim Davis, who was at the center of so much national attention there. How do you read this? I mean, I know it's an off-year election, but who came out for Bevin in a way that surprised the political chattering class in Kentucky, Sam?
Well, again, I think it's that coalition of Tea Party and evangelical voters who maybe haven't voted in recent elections. You know, we were really caught off guard by this one. Not so much by Bevin winning, but it was the margin, a 9-point victory that I think really surprised us the most. If you combine these results with Mitch McConnell's race last year, you know, for so much of the year, those of us in Kentucky and in the national media thought that we were looking at a close race between McConnell and Democrat Allison Lundgren Grimes, and that turned out to be about a 16-point margin. So I do think that, you know, I don't think you can overstate the role of the state's no other way to put it, contempt for President Barack Obama. He's always struggled here. His approval ratings hover around 30%. And Republicans have been very effective at painting their Democratic opponents as rubber stamps for Obama. We thought maybe that would be different this year because so much of what was being talked about were specific to the state. It was easy to look at last year as a referendum on the president, and that made some sense because it was a federal race. Apparently, voters didn't get the memo that this was about a state election, and they were very much voting with their feelings towards the president on the forefront of their minds.
Implications for the presidential race in 2016, Sam, either in Kentucky, if it's no longer the least bit purple or even pink, or nationally?
I guess I would say this. I think those of us who do this for a living that have studied the history of elections, we tend to believe that there's a certain set of rules that govern who goes up and who comes down in elections. Matt Bevin defied every single one of those. He really struggled with consistency. He picked fights with his own party. He picked fights with the media. And I mean,
a total newcomer to politics. I mean,
that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And I can't tell you how many Republican insiders were telling me how much they disliked this guy and weren't going to vote for him. And then he wins in a landslide. And I do think that outsider status has a lot to do with it. So I think maybe when we're looking at the national stage, when we're looking at the Ben Carsons and the Donald Trumps, and we're just sort of expecting gravity to take over and for them to come crashing back down to earth, there's, you know, voters are not necessarily getting that message. They're making up their own minds.
Juana, hope here, bolstering Donald Trump this week or Ben Carson in the Kentucky outcome?
I think that's certainly what we're seeing from the results in Kentucky this week and from races across the country is that there is something to be said for this being the year of the outsider. Voters seem very frustrated and tired with the status quo. I've spent some time traveling the country following these campaigns. And the number one thing I've heard from people is that they're tired of politics as usual, that they're tired of the same Washington class promising to deliver and then not doing that, just falling back on old conventions. The biggest applause lines in some of the speeches I've heard from Donald Trump, frankly, have been those taking shots at the Republican establishment, folks like Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. So it's been very fascinating to watch that development. Now, whether or not that can actually translate into these candidates building formidable organizations around the country that they would need to, in fact, win the Republican nomination and go on to win the presidency, I'm not sure. But if I'm an establishment type in this presidential race, I'm getting a little worried right now, and I'm trying to figure out how to distance myself from official Washington as far as I possibly can.
Jack Beatty, a little Kentucky shot across the bow of establishment Republicans or Democrats this week?
Well, yes, but, you know, I would have been surprised at the other outcome, frankly. This is a long been in train in Kentucky. You know, but there is something striking here. Matt Bevin, he promised to end Kentucky's participation in Obamacare. He won with 500,000 votes. As it happens, that's the number of Kentuckians who'd signed up for Obamacare. Now, suppose they had all voted and a few had brought along a friend, Bevin would have lost. Question, why did self-interest fail to mobilize the people who lose if Bevin won? In the bluegrass state where President Obama lost to Mitt Romney by 23 points, yep. Obamacare goes by the acceptable moniker Kentucky Connect. Question for Sam, did Bevin's challenger Jack Conway run away from the 500,000 Kentuckians enrolled in Kentucky Connect because it was connected to Obama?
Sam?
There was initial, I think, reluctance to embrace the law. I think what you saw last year with Grimes was she wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. As this campaign went on, the Democrat Jack Conway really stepped into it, embracing it more and calling out Matt Bevin repeatedly for wanting to kick 500,000 people off their health insurance. I think the thing you have to remember is we're talking about, of that figure, about 400,000 of them got their health insurance by the expanded Medicaid eligibility requirements to 138% of the federal poverty level. You know, Republicans were, I think, betting all along that these weren't people that were going to show up to vote. And clearly that bet proved to be true.
Let's go to the issue of Republican debate. They'll be back on the stage again next week, only eight this time. Chris Christie, Mike Huckabee won't be up there. But there was a kind of rebellion among the candidates this week. They said they didn't want the Republican National Committee to represent them anymore in negotiation with the TV networks where those debates would appear and that they would write the rules. Donald Trump wanted to write his own. Here on Monday on her Fox News show was anchor Megyn Kelly, who, of course, is tangled with Donald Trump, ridiculing Republican candidates' debate demands.
The network should commit that they will not ask hand-raising questions, yes or no questions, allow candidate-to-candidate questions, and then maybe like a foot massage.
A foot massage? What next? Wanda Summers, at the end of this week, did the candidates' rebellion work? Do they have more leverage over how these debates are going to work, or are they just back in the same box?
You know, this is such an inside Washington, inside the Beltway issue. But the one thing that I think will work for the candidates out of this is that no Republican candidate will ever do wrong with their base by tangling with the press and attacking the press and saying that the press is confusing their message or bashing them. That is always a winning thing that I've heard in stump speeches from House and Senate races across the country to the presidential level. But ultimately, I'm not sure that they really actually came out with any resolution. We saw they had this big meeting in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. to discuss this, where it seemed like they were going to have a letter sent out that would have the support of most of the campaigns. And then day after day, you see candidates breaking away saying that they couldn't in good faith support that. And so I think what we're going to see on the debate stage next week, this is sponsored by Fox Business and The Wall Street Journal, is a debate that probably in a lot of ways looks a lot of like the past debates we've seen this cycle, except for the fact that the players are a little bit different based on the newest polling numbers.
Sam, I don't know if this is entirely inside the Beltway. I mean, these have been pretty well-watched debates, and everybody witnessed the tangling. I think there was some popular support, some, for Republicans getting in there and saying, we want this done differently. What does it tell us that they couldn't, between them, muster the clout to pull that off?
Well, I mean, I think the idea of these guys getting on the same page to mount an offensive against the networks was probably never going to happen. But I think Juana makes a good point. You're right. I mean, this is a story that people in places like Kentucky are talking about, and nobody's sticking up for John Harwood or CNBC. I mean, you know, as ridiculous as it might look to us that, you know, these candidates basically want to be able to ask and answer their own questions.
Yeah.
I don't think Republican caucus goers in Iowa share that view. I think they look at this as an us versus them, mainstream media versus these Republican candidates who they think are getting an unfair shake.
Jack, what do you see in the debate realm this time around?
Well, you know, Tom, the dust up over the future debate format, I think it pales before a controversy touching on character involving Marco Rubio, Donald Trump, and Ben Carson. Now, according to former Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough, quote, Marco lied about his financials, end quote, when asked about his debt-fueled private life. On Trump, well, you could go on like the brook forever listing his whoppers, but for the record, his claim that John Kasich sat on the board of Lehman Brothers, false. Carson? According to Jim Garrity of the Conservative National Review, Carson's denials of any relationship to, you know, that dodgy maker of medical supplements, he called those, Garrity did, bald-faced lies, end quote. Dodgy, that's not a bad word for Carson's campaign, which spends 69% of the funds it raises on more fundraising. By contrast, Bernie Sanders spends 4%. Question, is Carson running for president, or is he running a brand-building direct mail scam? Maybe one of the moderators of Tuesday's debate will, you know, risk riling the audience and ask him.
Juana, what do you say? I'm looking at a latest NBC poll. Carson leads Donald Trump.
Whether or not Ben Carson is mounting a legitimate campaign for president, there is certainly evidence that at least among Republican primary voters in these surveys that we've seen, that his message is taking it in hold. Ben Carson, for a lot of people, particularly in the Black community, is a household name. You know, he's someone where his autobiography was recommended reading in grades, elementary school and middle school for many people that I know. So he does have a history of accomplishments. That said, this last week, we have seen any number of troubling and factually inaccurate statements and denials from Ben Carson of things that have in his past, as Jack just mentioned, of basic scientific fact that he has pointed back to giving biblical answers to. And I think for a lot of people, that is rather troubling. CNN has recently been investigating into his past and looking at statements he said of violence that he's had in his past and been able to find any evidence of that. And I think that kind of vetting is really important. And then it's important for Republican primary voters and those who may be supporting Ben Carson in a general election to know whether or not the things that he says to be true about his past and about his life actually are.
Yes, we had questions about his whole story of being this angry teen who then tried to stab a friend and saw the error of his ways and found religion and was transformed. Multiple news sources this week questioning that story. Yesterday, Carson here trying to clarify the story to reporters in Miami, Florida.
The stabbing, attempted stabbing incident occurred when I was 13 or 14, trying to hit my mother in the head with a hammer. That was around the same time as the stabbing incident.
And the two incidents before your mother, were those classmates? Were they friends? Were they neighbors? How do you characterize? Because our investigation could not find these people.
Well, why would you be able to find them? What makes you think you would be able to find them? Unless I tell you who they are.
Sam Youngman, what do you make of this? Questions being asked about kind of his backstory in the same week that the polls are saying, hey, he's on top.
Well, I wish I had a nickel for every time I've covered a presidential candidate when we're trying to verify whether or not he attacked his mother with a hammer. Such a common theme in presidential politics. I go back to this idea, however, that, you know, there's this idea I think we have that there are certain rules of politics. And I keep – maybe it's just because I've spent the last 72 hours questioning everything I know about politics.
Yeah.
But, you know, Matt Bevin is a good example of somebody who said things that were consistently and demonstrably untrue. And ultimately, the voters believed him more than they believed the media reports exposing those inconsistencies. I do think it's a liability for Carson in a general election, no question about it. But I don't know that it necessarily hurts him that much in places like Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina.
And then this week, you know, the other stuff saying that none of the signers of the Declaration of Independence had ever had experience in elected office. Historians saying patently untrue. Thomas Jefferson, Sam Adams, John Hancock, a lot of others elected members of colonial assemblies. But then the stuff about the pyramids. Now, this is from a long time ago, but that's what presidential campaign seasons do. They bring it back out 17 years ago, 1998, delivered a commencement address at Andrews University in Michigan. That's a college founded by Seventh-day Adventists. That's his religion. He introduced his unusual theory there about the ancient pyramids in Egypt.
My own personal theory is that Joseph built the pyramids in order to store grain.
Now, of course, they have been widely understood by archaeologists to be the tombs of pharaohs. On Thursday, NBC's Chris Jansing asked Carson whether he stood by his long-held belief that the pyramids in Egypt were built by Joseph from the Bible to store grain.
Do you still believe Joseph built the pyramids to store grain?
I think that's a plausible explanation to how they got built.
Scientifically plausible?
It's a plausible explanation. It's a personal belief.
Juana Summers, where does this go? It can sound kind of wacky. I mean, even to be talking about it makes you sound kind of, you know, Twilight Zone-y. But Ben Carson appears to be to welcome that what's understood to be the ahistorical.
I don't even know where to start with this. Look, I'm really, really hesitant to criticize anybody on the grounds of faith because that's a really personal thing. But when you have somebody who's
is this faith or is this history? Is this about facts?
I don't know that you can disentangle the two here because of the explanation that Ben Carson gives talking about Joseph building the pyramids, which is derived directly from biblical teachings and his roots as a Seventh-day Adventist. What I do think that means is, and we had a piece on this on Mashable this week, is that Ben Carson's faith does open up some real questions to ask about how he would run a campaign as president, how he would be the president of the United States, and how he would handle major issues. And I think that what we've seen here with this debate over the pyramids and his understanding of these well-known, well-attributed facts, which is personally what I believe, and I think that's made that fair game for us.
Jack, I guess we're going to come back and look at Ben Carson, but getting a second look, a cockeyed look, but doing very well in the polls.
Yes, it doesn't seem to have hurt him so far. However, these may be, what, over a border, as you say, Tom, Twilight Zone stuff.
I I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Donald Trump is scheduled to host Saturday Night Live this weekend. NBC says a promo for the show where he insults GOP rival Ben Carson was recorded and leaked. It's since been yanked off of SNL's YouTube site, but before it was yanked, here it is.
Because of equal time rules for television, Mr. Trump can only speak for 4 seconds in this promo.
So let me just say this. Ben Carson is a complete and total loser.
Does that still work? I don't know. Former senator, one-time presidential candidate, and actor Fred Thompson died this week at 73. Here he is as Arthur Branch on Law and Order.
If I'd wanted a yes man, you'd have been out on your butt a long time ago. I need someone who can tell me when my britches are unbuttoned.
And the Kansas City Royals rallied to tie the game in the ninth and put up 5 runs in the 12th to win their first World Series in 30 years. Here's Royals second baseman Ben Zobrist.
Watching this group just keep battling back, you know, just never give up no matter what the score is in the game. And it's just incredible.
We're looking at a week in the news, a Russian plane down, lots of politics this week. We've got news on the Keystone front, on the employment front, and more. Sam Youngman is here from the Lexington Herald Leader in Kentucky, where they've had a lot of politics this week. Juana Summers, politics editor for Mashable, Jack Beatty's with us. You can join us on Ben Carson, Marco Rubio. What do you think of the Democrats this week? Bernie Sanders interview on socialism on NPR this morning and how he understands it. How do you read the TransCanada folks pulling back on their Keystone pipeline push? And middle-aged white people, what is pushing up your death rate? What's going on there? Let's go to Dennis in Princeton, Wisconsin. Dennis, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, my question or my comment was about Ben Carson, and I find it to be maybe a little dangerous when we don't, when we aren't willing to question how someone's religious views might affect how they would be a president. So, for instance, his belief that Joseph built the pyramids, what if he gets into office and views Putin as the second coming of the devil and truly believes this and that it's revelation times and how that might affect him? I would say that people might say to me, well, that's a crazy thought that he would take it that far. But it would also, in my mind, be crazy to believe the pyramids were built to store grain.
Juana Summers, I'm curious how you respond to that. You're a political reporter. Americans have prided themselves on not judging people on the basis of their religion. And yet, you can imagine how things might come into policy. You hear what Dennis is scratching his head about. What do you say, Juana?
I think that Dennis makes a really valid point in that there are some valid questions about Ben Carson's Seventh-day Adventist faith. One of them that we posed out at Mashable is, given the doctrine of the church and how it views women, would Ben Carson ever appoint a woman to a cabinet
position? How does it view women? I don't really know how Seventh-day Adventists look at that.
Well, I'm not a Seventh-day Adventist, and I certainly don't want to speak for someone else's faith. But from
you had a piece
our
at Mashable, you said.
We did. We had a freelancer, a woman who was born and raised in the church and is now separated from it. And the understanding that she gave me is that women are seen as a helpmeet, but aren't really – there's a very strict traditional gender roles that are had in the church. A lot of men and women don't really work together. Women are seen in this maternal role, staying home, homeschooling, raising the kids, being involved in the family and the church, but not really out there in the workforce in that way. So she questioned whether or not Ben Carson would actually be able to work with women if he was president of the United States. And that's a question I would have as well, given that, you know, we do make up 50% of the world's population.
Yes, we have noticed that. Jose in Marietta, Georgia. Jose, you're on the air.
Hi. I remember the days of Jim Jones when he took down almost 1,000 people, I see almost a political equivalent of the Jim Jones syndrome, where the media is the enemy, and we must retreat from the media's questions about what we're doing because I know, and I just see that in a political syndrome landscape situation here, and it's scary.
Jose, we've got it. Thinking about Jim Jones, and yet a lot of Americans look here at Ben Carson and feel reassurance. Let me hold that for a second, Jose. One more. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
The thing I'm really struck by is sort of looking through my background's history, so I can do this, but mm-hmm. It's the lens of history, of compromise, of a whole batch of things. And what really, really, really troubles me now is that we have the real possibility of an outsider getting in who has no sense of governance, who has no sense of compromise, and has no sense of how things link together, how they correlate, and how in God's name is a democracy, and democracy is a fragile show. So if that starts happening, could you really begin to lose the underpinnings of what you're trying to preserve? And how do folks, you know, who are voting for the outsider, if he has no sense of governance, who on earth do they expect him to be about paying bills, about infrastructure, about pensions, about the very structure of things?
Peter, we've got it. I appreciate your call as well. Sam Youngman, jump in there. You've got Jose worried about going all the way to Jim Jones here, and Peter just worried about candidates without perhaps an appreciation for the way things work. Now, a lot of people are unhappy with the way things are working, but Peter's looking more deeply in a way to look at, you know, the structure of the democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, while the discussion of this particular faith, using Ben Carson as an example, is new, the questions aren't, and you don't have to look back far. For an example, in 2012, I lost track of how many Sundays I was sitting in a Mormon church a few pews behind the Romney family. Ultimately, I think Republican voters came to view Romney's commitment to his faith on its merits more than the faith itself, or especially the history of the faith. Especially, you know, some of the things Juana's bringing up are not unique to Ben Carson's faith, with some of the same questions that dogged Governor Romney.
Romney had been a governor of a state. He'd put his oar into and worked through the system. Now you've got these guys, and people are embracing them, who are really coming from outside, and that seems to be where the Peter's concern lies.
No question, and I don't think he's certainly not alone in that concern. I mean, especially if you talk to Democrats here in Kentucky over the last 3 days, they are absolutely terrified. And you hear people saying things like, you know, if you were getting on a plane, would you say, I don't want that pilot because he's a career pilot? Or if you're going into surgery, you know, I don't want that doctor because he's a career doctor. So I think in a lot of ways, if we're electing these outsider candidates as we did here in Kentucky, then basically what we're doing is we're embarking on an experiment to see if it works.
But Jack Beatty, at the same time, you've got this story out this week looking at death rates among middle-aged white Americans, just to take one group, and they're up, you know, unlike every other group. Now, this isn't just some setbacks in the job market, Jack. This is a major demographic chunk of the American population, not just looking at even maybe they lost some homes in the recession, and as bad as that is. This is actual death rates up. I mean, you can see what people may look around and say, we need something different.
You know, the title of the study could be Death by Despair. It really documents not only a statistical singularity, but a moral outrage, Tom. The 22% increase in the death rate among white, middle-aged, working-class Americans brought on by suicide, drink and drugs, chronic pain, and acute economic disappointment. For the white working class, the American dream has shipwrecked on an iron shore of technological change, deunionization, and imports, foreign goods. The death rate began rising a year after Bill Clinton's China trade deal. You know, in 1979, the real median wage for white male high school grads, $19.76 an hour. 2014, $17.25 an hour. Now, the Republican candidates are speaking to the fears of the white working class about falling further in a Browning America. The Democrats, on the other hand, are somehow promising to raise their incomes. Who knows how? The election is shaping up, really, between a contest, at least for the white working class, between the politics of resentment and the politics of remedy. But until this report on death by despair, we didn't know how much the white working class has to resent or how hard the remedy for their bitter condition.
But how surprised can an observer be, Jack, if people are going to outsiders when you've got suffering that acute? And look, not to say that many other portions of the country haven't taken their hits, but this is standing out unlike every other racial group, every other ethnic group, unlike their counterparts in other rich countries. This group, how can we be surprised if they're looking to people from outside the system?
Not at all. Not at all. And when Trump talks about, you know, let's get these 11 million, quote, illegals out of the country, a lot of people, some of these people hear, my God, my wages could go up if I didn't have to compete with these workers. When the Republicans just in general telegraphed that the Democrats pay too much attention to minorities, you know, giving them free stuff is the way Ben Carson puts it. White working class voters shake their heads on that, and they say, "Well, they're not paying attention to me." So yes, there's a real emotion is high because conditions are bad.
Craig in Omaha, Nebraska. Craig, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Okay, well, I'm calling about these middle-aged white people dying more.
Yes.
Well, I see a whole genre of different stuff. Okay, first off, you got, I call them babies having babies, young children, you know, 14, 15, 16, whatever, having babies.
Yep.
Trying to raise babies. The middle, I think the family unit is broke down. Then on the flip side of that, too much processed food. Nobody's eating, cooking anymore.
Yep.
So, you know, so then with the family unit broken down, you know, so, I mean, you can just put the pieces together. Family unit's broken down, so there ain't no, basically no family. Okay, people ain't cooking. They're just eating whatever, you know, processed foods. So you go the whole distance, and I don't think these people see hope. A lot of them, I mean, it's just, I think the country's broke down.
Craig, I really appreciate your call. I mean, that is pretty basic stuff if you're talking about family breakdown. Well, people not even nourishing themselves properly, it doesn't take long when you get in that channel to be in trouble. I mean, Juana, into that picture comes Donald Trump with his book out this week, and the title is Crippled America. In the past, I cannot imagine an American candidate for the presidency bringing a book out with such a grim vision of the country in the title, but there it is, Juana.
It is. And, you know, that's Donald Trump's whole shtick this cycle so far. His slogan that you see on these trucker hats on the campaign trail and across the country is Make America Great Again. What we're hearing is Donald Trump tap into that discontentment, that fear, that resentment that the caller was talking about, this, the fact that things aren't as good as people want them to be. And I think he's really made his mark by doing that. Now, of course, you've heard other candidates say, well, America's already great. We need to make it even better than it is right now. But Donald Trump may have a point when you're, if you're talking to that working middle class who keeps seeing the stagnation that they can't escape. And I think that's why you've seen him do so well in the polls, is because people might find that refreshing, that he's actually speaking to where they're at in life and this place that they can't figure out how to dig out of.
Let's go to Gordon in Worcester, Massachusetts. Gordon, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Let me just say that my question to your excellent panel is, what do they think about Bernie Sanders changing his identity from a democratic socialist to a social democrat?
And why are you suggesting? Are you advising that, Gordon? Are you? Is that what you're up to?
Yes. Yes.
And why?
I am.
Why?
Why? Because you're a wordsmith. I'm a wordsmith to some extent. And words have connotations, have specific definitions. And unfortunately, socialist has the whole connotation of communist. And that's a factor throughout the world, and it's certainly a factor in this community.
Gordon, we've got it. Our time is short. Let me take it right there. Sam Youngman, how about it? I don't know if you heard Bernie Sanders this morning talking with Steve Inskeep on NPR. It was a very good and interesting exchange about what he means by democratic socialist. And he said, look, you know, this is not taking over the commanding heights of the economy. It's about, the way he put it this morning, was sort of expanding Medicare, expanding Social Security, free university education. But you hear our caller says that may still be a problem for Mr. Sanders. Senator Sanders, what do you say?
Well, I agree with the caller that words, you know, words are important. Words certainly have different connotations. I also think that when it comes to presidential campaigns, that kind of nuance is basically campaign cancer. However, you know, I think you've got to say, look, this guy, you can call it whatever you want to, but basically what he's talking about is socialism. And can you imagine, you know, just even 10 years ago, we'd be at a place in this country where somebody who's wearing that label could be enjoying the success that he has. And I think it just illustrates, going back to what we were just talking mm-hmm. about, that Republicans don't have a monopoly on this disillusion that's turned to raw anger and this desire to see somebody who just completely turns everything on its head. Clearly, it's exists on both sides.
Keystone Pipeline, Sam, is that just being rolled over to the next presidency? Is that what TransCanada is up to by saying let's put off the consideration?
That certainly seems to be the case, although I think, you know, if you're a Canada watcher, you're sort of curious to see how much of this has to do with Justin Trudeau's ascendancy there.
He's less friendly, I guess, to the whole operation, the tar sands.
That's certainly the sense that I get. But I do think that in this country, at least, we had sort of decided that we were going to wait and see what the next president thought about it.
And Juana Summers, quickly, Paul Ryan won't work with this president, he says, Obama, on immigration because Obama has gone on executive authority. Is that another, let's roll it over to another administration, another president, Juana?
It certainly seems that way, particularly on issues like immigration, which Paul Ryan, as Speaker, has directly addressed. That is not something it looks like is going to happen while President Obama is still in office. Paul Ryan has effectively closed the door on immigration reform.
Jack Beatty, transformational election coming up in 2016 or something else? You've got high stakes and big sense of drama the country's feeling here.
Yes, and they're going to be, as you know, the parties are as polarized, as different on the issues as they've been in my lifetime. So, yes, it could be a transformational election. Which way will the country go? You know, speaking of this, people, outsiders, I went to a Bernie Sanders rally the other day. The title of his speech could be America the Crippled.
There we go. Juana Summers, Sam Youngman, Jack Beatty, thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.